We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
What's up, y'all? It's Drewski, and I've teamed up with Mountain Dew to produce a hilarious new basketball podcast called The Dew Zone with Drewski. Learn the backstories of your favorite ballers and celebrities like Jamal Murray.
Did you have like a favorite team? Was it the Raptors at the time or no? Was the Raptors even started around that time?
Come on, bro.
I ain't that old, fam. You're talking like I'm 50.
Taylor Rooks, Asia Wilson, and many more. You won't want to miss this. Listen to The Dew Zone with Drewski on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
In the Know, the Bourbon Street Shots podcast. It's all Pelicans, all the time.
And welcome to the podcast. It's been a little while since I had a recording because Mr. McNamara decided that he was too sad and depressed to do any more podcasts. That's not actually true. He'll be back in a little bit. He's taking a little hiatus. So I said I brought on Jason Calmes to very darkly analyze this team. Because actually, I don't think Jason, you're not really as down on this team as most people seem to be after this losing streak. Would that be an accurate statement?
I am sunshine and rainbows.
Sunshine and rainbows. Yeah, I think that might be a bit much too.
Comparatively speaking,
yeah,
so rainbow in the dark.
Our last podcast, we were talking about, hey, they've been having this uptick. Maybe they're going to continue to go. Hey, if they just do this again, they're only a few games back of 500, and now they're 7-15. They've lost some pretty uncomfortable games that they probably should have won. When you play against Memphis when they don't have Mike Conley, and you're right there at the end, it's kind of a kick in the teeth to go to double overtimes over and over again and still come up short. It's kind of hard to watch sometimes. I actually enjoyed the Memphis game. Well, let me change that. I enjoyed the tenseness and excitement of the Memphis game. The basketball was maybe not the prettiest basketball on the planet.
Anytime you have those close losses, and from a certain point of view, you know, forcing overtime, whether it's a win or a loss, is close because it's tied at the end of regulation. And then the more you repeat that, the closer it is, regardless of the final result. As an entertainment spectacle, that's very good. Mm-hmm. As you said, as a basketball clinic, less.
Yeah.
But the frustration side of the seesaw goes way up because you can sit there and look at those key plays at the end, or you can be frustrated about all the missed shots earlier, turnovers, stuff like that. Or you can say, oh, well, we were missing these guys, or we were missing part of Davis because his ankle was hurt, ..
Right.
So, I mean, I think sometimes people get more frustrated when they imagine what could have been. When truly it was a very close game.
It was a very close game. And, you know, Langston Galloway got stupid hot or we wouldn't even have been in it. So I'm going to fire a quick question at you. You got to pick one person. there is somebody invades your home, steals your children, takes them to the nearest basketball court, ties them up in the corner, and has a machine gun trained on them. It says, you can pick one Pelican player to hit a three-point shot right now. If they hit it, I'll let your children go. Now, depending on how much you love your children, I'm assuming you're probably going to pick, you know, somebody who's probably likely to hit the shot. But which Pelican would it be?
What I would pick normally, right, assuming all the things being equal, would be I would probably pick Holiday. I just big believe in Holiday, and he's not a silly choice. I probably in that game, if that had happened during the game and I was like, I'll catch up with you as soon as the game's over, I'd probably pick Galloway.
Okay.
Moore would be another good choice, but just me overall, I would pick Holiday.
Have you seen what he's shooting this year?
it's not the numerically strong choice.
which is kind of odd coming from a mathematician. You realize that, don't you?
I understand that counting plays a role in this. But also, the shots you can make under duress, right? The shots you do make under duress and you perform there is different than the way you perform during most of the game, depending on your role.
You know what I just realized? Drew Holiday actually has the highest three-point percentage on this team. It's up higher than I thought it was at this point. I misspoke because technically Dante Cunningham is still our best shooter. He's just been out.
That's unfair to the kidnappers.
Right. Oh, yeah, so Langston Galloway is actually 0.05% or 0.5% behind now, Drew Holiday.
Yeah, with sample size effects, Galloway is still probably better. But under pressure, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. You saw the end of the Memphis game, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, wide right. So.
Yeah.
I'm not picking on him. I'm just saying I believe in Drew.
Okay. But it's not as bad of a pick as I thought it would be. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
See, I should just shut up before I start making fun of you. So, I don't know. I have so infrequently seen a team that misses. When this team misses, it misses just badly. Like, Buddy Hield is the perfect, boiled down essence of this team as a shooter. When Buddy Hield takes a shot, either it just snaps net and hits nothing, or he misses completely everything. He doesn't hit rim. He doesn't hit backboard. He just flat out misses. And it feels the same way for this team. Just, they're such bad shooters at times. It can be so bad to watch.
So the other night, I was feeling it, right? So I said on the side account that, what Gentry is doing is getting people open shots. So the Pelicans, all these people who can't shoot, somehow are getting open shots, which is how we know they can't shoot.
Right.
So I'm assigning that to Gentry, which you can pick on now or later if you want. But when the guys don't shoot, or they shoot and they don't make it, the defense eventually figures it out and they play their hand elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Right? They're willing to let those guys beat them, and they quintuple team Davis,
right,
which works sometimes. And that the real answer to all of this is the guys need to make shots. Now, that's far easier said than done, right? Because if I could just bottle that, I would be a coach somewhere.
Right.
But it's not really those guys have to make shots. It's that some shots have to be made. So, can Evans or some of these other guys that aren't in the rotation coming back really make things click in the way Drew coming back did before he got on the scouting report?
Absolutely. And so this is actually where I'm going. Like, I don't think we have good shooters, and I think that's pretty obvious. Mm-hmm. This is earth-shaking to no one listening to this podcast. But I will say the reason why Drew came back and suddenly we saw some free-flowing offense was because people were not – they didn't realize that Drew Holiday was the only person who could get penetration on this team. So if you make sure that you put your best defender on Drew, you're going to shut everyone down. It took them a little while to realize that, hey, Tim Frazier's maybe not the biggest threat in the world, and everybody else on this team has trouble dribbling and chewing gum at the same time. Tyreke Evans can dribble and chew gum at the same time. I mean, he's going to cause that first crack. And, you know, Ryan Anderson, for all the flaws he had in the world, that guy could catch the ball at the three-point line, fake, and come up with 17 ways to attack you and make you have to go defend him differently. He actually is a good offensive player. And this Pelicans team, just take a minute, because now that we're seeing more Frazier, Drew Holiday running together, there's less staggering of the two of them, which I think this is like one of the most dramatic mistakes we're making right now. Just try to watch Etuan Moore or Langston Galloway bring the ball up the floor and how the opposing team picks them up. Like, they immediately stretch their defense. They immediately send a guy out to harass them because they know these guys aren't strong ball handlers. They're going to have to turn their back and dribble down safely and pass the ball conservatively, and they can be pressured. They're not going to break down anyone. They're not going to run some dazzling pick and roll. So I think Tyreke Evans has, if he's at all healthy and at all in shape, which both of those are huge question marks, and I've said before, I don't really think Tyreke Evans is going to be able to play all that much for us this year before we try to get rid of him. But if he came back and we had anything like close to what Tyreke Evans was when he was moderately healthy, he's going to make a huge difference because he can actually put pressure on you. You can't just defend him one way and then not worry about him dribbling past you.
Yeah, and if the defense has to change as a result, that's going to make life a little bit easier on the worst players. Mm-hmm. That, I think, is the bigger real effect that will be lasting if Tyreke lasts. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, and so, I mean, that's my real question there, is saying that I'm viewing this team currently as about a 500 team, meaning if they can continue from here on out 500 and end up with the 36 wins, right? I also think it's reasonable that if some of their players come online with baseline luck, which, whatever, I'm not going to predict anything other than that, they could do a little bit better than that and get close to 500 overall, right? And if through someone else's misfortune they made the playoffs, they would be quickly shown home to the couch.
Right.
Because there's nothing, right? So I don't see the point in making the playoffs. From a basketball point of view, I see it a lot from a business point of view. But I guess what I'm wondering then is, are they teetering on the edge of actually getting more than 500 basketball as opposed to like a couple runs based on this, you know, the sort of full construction of the team? Or is it really just the, quote, add three wins stuff that our friend McNamara hates?
Yeah.
Three wins better.
So I'll be 100% honest. I think you think that, you know, Tyreke Evans comes back, plays okay. Maybe he's not 100% healthy, but you feel like this team could, you know, a likely outcome would be them just playing 500 ball the rest of the season, right?
I think that is probably about equally likely to play anywhere between, like, you know, 0.5 and 0.6.
Okay.
You know, kind of win percentage, yeah.
I mean, unless they do something drastic and make a move that we're not expecting and bring in a wing player who couldn't create. I think this team is playing about at its level. Like, Anthony Davis, the dude is just getting beat up. And he put on weight this year. He's stronger. He could take the pounding better. He's fighting through, like, injuries that, you know, other years he probably wouldn't have. He is putting up a crazy season. And at some point, I can't see that he won't go down for a few games here and there. Like, you know, a three-game stretch and then a four-game stretch. And, you know, every single time we think we have somebody coming off the list, somebody else goes on it. Like, as much as I killed Dante Cunningham, just having a warm body who can run around for 15 minutes chasing somebody with lots of energy, although in Dante's case it was a lot more than 15 minutes, unfortunately, that does matter to how tired people get it by the end of the game. I think the best thing I'm going to expect out of them is like 400 ball for the rest of the season. I don't see it. Their offense is just, I brought it up in the off season. I made a little post about it. I said, you know, this team basically said offensive players who are leaving out the door, we're not going to bother, you know, worrying about you. We're going to bring in all baseline foundation defensive players who have very little in the offensive skill set. You look at my analysis of Langston Galloway and Etuan Moore, neither of them could run a pick and roll really in their previous jobs in the NBA. They really went the other direction. And I kind of mentioned, I was like, you know, there's a possibility here that they just went a little too far. And in the NBA, you can slip from, meh, they're a pretty decent offense to terrible if you're just missing a piece or two. And they lost that piece or two. I don't see how this offense just gets awesome unless Tyreek suddenly has, you know, a knee removal and replacement with a cyborg knee. That's just not likely.
Yeah. I mean, the shots have to fall. So, yeah. I mean, that's my claim. And I'm not saying they are going to fall, but I just think there's enough luck around to get into about that 500. And your point about Davis is spot on. I think one of the answers from what I'm saying is, you know, sort of baseline level luck is that he's going to play, you know, 70 games. Now, somebody might say, you can't expect that because he's injury prone. Whatever. I'm setting my terms.
Okay.
Yeah. This is what I'm saying, that under these circumstances, regardless of whether they're reasonable, this is what I think is going to happen. It's unclear how much of the time Davis missed in the past was due to injury, due to choice, due to doctors, et cetera, et cetera. Right now, he's playing when if I were on staff, would make some suggestion that he should not play. Right.
Yeah.
And he's continuing to play. So enough important people are involved. So unless he's hurt, and he's played hurt before.
Yeah.
I just don't know. I mean, his you could say like, oh, he's going to be less effective. Boy, he's pretty effective right now.
Right.
A lot of the advanced metrics agree that despite all of our armchair whining and thinking about back-to-backs and kinesiology this or whatever, you know, he's different in lots of ways, and he can somehow keep his usage and efficiency up,
yeah,
which is kind of the definition of a superstar, right?
Yeah.
So, I hear what you're saying. I'm slow to move analytically like that. So that's what I see. What you're saying is not insane. That's just where I'm going to go. And a little bit of that showmanship, right? I disagree with you. You disagree with me. Hmm. We make the big money.
That's right.
Because everybody's listening to us. But really, that's, you know, kind of where I'm at.
So I gotta move on now to the big, big boiling over question that everybody on Twitter wants to talk about, it seems like. Is Anthony Brown the answer? I don't mean Allen Iverson. I mean the solution to all our problems.
So I'm not sure about like if this actual Anthony Brown is the answer to all our problems, but I will say that in a couple different ways he is, right? So for one thing, he does his job pretty okay, right? He can sink some shots, and at some point, if people start believing it, that will help.
You got to shoot better than 28% for people to start believing it, though. This is his second season of shooting 28% from three.
I agree, but I mean, he just got off the boat here,
yeah.
Right? I mean, in terms of the playbook, I'm saying when I look at his shot, you know, like I'm gonna say something. You can feel free to bleep it out. But when Eric Gordon was rehabbing from his knee for several years, when he's right before he started to get healthy, and he was missing those threes instead of the threes before that, you could see that the arc on his shot was just better, and it was coming up short.
Right.
I don't know. He just seems like.
You like his form.
He has the right skills, right?
Okay. All right.
And that I can dial it in, okay? And I'm saying that if he can become a credible threat, not necessarily a good scorer, but a credible threat in a way that Aminu kind of was, another bad word, at one point, not at the end, right, but at one point early, he was kind of a credible threat until people – went away from him, right? So if he can do the opposite, get people to bend to him, that's okay. The other thing is being able to get some youth on the team and get that built-in that built-in development into the team is just good for the team overall,
right?
Long-term, regardless of all the other problems that are here.
Yeah.
Right.
This is something I found interesting. Anthony Brown, did you know that he is, like, by percentages, the fifth best rebounder on this entire team?
So I did not know that.
Isn't that ridiculous?
Yeah, that actually seems a little incredible to me.
He has a 10.1% total rebound percentage.
Normal.
So only Ajinsa, Ashik, Terrence Jones, and Davis are better.
Yeah, so he's the best non-big man.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah. Solomon Hill's at 7.5%. Dante Cunningham was at 8.8%. Yeah. So, like, he's doing stuff out there. Just, I find it really funny that... So, explain to me how Anthony Brown comes walking onto our court, and he has a career 3-point percentage of 28.6%. He's not really that much bigger than, say, Etuan Moore. He's definitely not any bigger than Buddy Hield, really. We have these guys already on, but suddenly Brown comes in and he's soaking up a whole bunch of backup minutes that those guys aren't getting any longer. And he's basically in there to take 3-point shots and try to defend people, but he's never been that good of a 3-point shooter, and he's okay at defending. You know, obviously, he rebounds a little bit. Like, how does that happen that he walks onto this team and suddenly they're just like, you're the answer, and they throw him out there for 20 minutes a game? Are they just trying him out?
Well, my cynical answer that's probably not totally insane is that was part of the deal
that he comes here,
right?
He was just sitting in the D League. Like, you think he had other offers and he was like, oh, I'll only come to you, Pelicans, if you guarantee me minutes?
He might have thought, or the agent might have been playing a couple people off or said, oh, I'll get something else later, et cetera, et cetera. Or they went in and said, you know, if you go do this and with these terms, then we're going to give you this amount because we might cut you at
some
point.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Right?
They got to make room for somebody eventually, right?
Yeah, and so we want to have the kind of deal that's friendly to us that'll let us cut you in case we want to bring Stevenson back.
Right.
Right? And that's not always viewed well when you, you know, commodify a player.
Right. That's a good, I hadn't even thought about that.
Yeah, so there's that. So that's what I mean by part of the deal. It's just that, like, you know, we're going to do you this and you do us that. And they've been very – this is going to sound worse than it is, but they've been very good about how they treat their very bad players.
That's true.
Right,
that's
of
true.
Course. What I mean are, like, their minimum contract-type players are the guys that are coming back, the guys that they're getting off the scrap heap, but the guys that have that that have some kind of blemish, whether it be real or perceived. Dante Cunningham with the off-court fake stuff that was tainting his reputation.
Yep.
Morrow had the hip thing.
Yep.
Right? And then they protected him a bit, which is why he wasn't played at the beginning, because his contract even had like something like, if you miss so many games for your hip, then we can cut you without your salary becomes not guaranteed or something like that.
You know, we have to do a study at some point of the number of guys the Pelicans have had over the last few years who have gone on to get paid somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And compare that to like other teams. How do they do, like, because the Pelicans have now had Ennis, technically Frazier, they got paid. He got paid by the Pelicans. They had Seth Curry. Curry's got a nice contract now. They've had a number of guys who have Ish Smith that they bring in. They kind of showcase for a little bit, and then they actually turn into actual real. It's almost like Dell is unearthing these guys pretty well. But
I wrote half of this,
okay,
of what you're describing in February of 2014.
Okay. I'm impressed you know the month.
I was in Arkansas, like, I remember.
Okay.
So I just remember. And I was noting, because sometimes we have to look very hard for the sun, that the minimum contracts that teams get are sometimes a measure of how good the team is in terms of reputation, right? Because
mm-hmm.
if, you know, David West is willing to go to certain teams for a men contract.
Right.
But clearly not most teams.
Right.
So if you take the best men contract in the league and say, where are they at, that means something. Okay. So I was looking at the men contracts the Pelicans, Hornets were getting over time. And they got better. to spare you the details. And then they don't continue because they move on and get paid somewhere else. And I think that is part of what not only the Pelicans try to do, which, by the way, is not enough, but is a good thing. It's a component of being a reasonable franchise. But it's something that the other side of the house does, too, is they look at those fringe guys, churn through them, and try to get that value out of an inefficient market, basically. They did that when the Saints went to the Super Bowl with a couple guys, et cetera, et cetera. And I do think that is a point of emphasis to some extent to try to say to go get these guys and treat them right, and they actually do a decent job at it too.
Yeah, it's just too bad they can't do have the same success with the guys that they pay huge gobs of money to.
See, that's the thing that sort of says, well, you have this, okay, but then it also makes what you just said hurt more.
Right.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you can find the best James Ennis or whatever, Tim Frazier, but you end up finding the worst Solomon Hill.
Right. God, he's such a disaster. Like, I've just tried, really I just try to avoid talking and thinking about him. Solomon Hill is a legitimate disaster. I don't know how well people remember Bruce Bowen's early career. That dude was bad. Like, he might have been a fine defensive player early on, but it wasn't until he could stop making all kinds of awful mistakes on offense and hit a shot here and there that he actually entered an NBA rotation and was a player that like, Pop grew to trust. And it took him a long time. I mean, it was like 4 or 5 years before he was to that point. He was in the league a while before anyone would do anything with him. So I can sit here and say that could happen with Solomon Hill, but, man, it's hard to see.
So I was talking with Andrew a couple weeks ago. By the way, I'm going to out him. He's graduating. We're all very proud of him.
Yeah.
So congratulations, Andrew. So we were out and talking about Hill. And, let's see what you think about this. What we ended up doing was trying to say, how do you, max out Hill? How do you get the most out of Hill? Now, regardless if it destroys the team, what position, how do you put him in a role that's going to make him the best? And I'm like, here's what I want out of him. If he's playing on the wing, he catches the ball and goes directly to it, goes directly to the rim. No questions asked. Do not shoot it. Go to the rim, which was kind of like what I wanted Aminu to do.
Yeah, but
he's
going go to dribble it off his own foot.
I'm not saying it's good. I'm saying it's the best.
Okay, I got you now. Right, okay.
So everybody's on the ring. But what they should be doing, and maybe this is where they're trying to go. I'm trying real hard here. He should be playing a four more and be more of like that garbage man role that Davis was in early with Monty.
Right.
Not seeing Hill as Davis. Okay. Because somebody's already going to misquote that. Be in that role where he doesn't actually shoot anything. But if the ball is up in the air above the rim, he can nudge it.
Yeah.
Right. And if not, he's going for a rebound if it's the wrong rim. So that's what I want. Garbage man, rebound, and if you have to be playing the wing because of the rotation, just don't pass, don't do anything, just kill. I don't know. Do you think any of this is in any way a reasonable way that would – is that the best way to maximize him, and is that a reasonable way to incorporate him into the offense?
I don't know. He might only be shooting 30% from three, and I might just have him just do that. I really, every time he does something with the ball on the move, it kind of freaks me out. He's not good. But they can also just cheat off of him on the three-point line. So he's shooting 29%, and, you know, that equates to a 0.9 points per shot kind of. It's not good, but it's not awful. Which is what his 2% shooting is right now. Like, he's terrible when he's moving to that 33% from the field. Like, wow, he's an explosive athlete and he cannot finish anything. And that's not even taking into account the fact that he turns the ball over on those drives so often.
Yeah, I mean the turnovers are killer. The team overall protects the ball very well, right? If I remember the stats right.
Yeah.
So it's like his turnovers are just incandescent.
Although the team actually isn't protecting it as well as they used to. Frazier and Holiday, their turnover numbers have spiked the team's percentages to the point where it's not like Frazier was better by himself than he is with Holiday, and I think part of that's just the rest of the league getting used to Frazier and figuring out how they can make him get into trouble. But Holiday's not helping it. I guess they're still eighth in turnover percentage, but for a while they were sitting down around four. So
yes, they were like, they were certainly top five and not a top 10. So there's a little bit of a drop. We'll see. They're also a little bit of a losing streak. Maybe it's correlated. I don't know what's real.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah.
In other news, their defense is all right in terms of defensive rating.
Yeah, it's average. It's like, yeah. And that is refreshing. Like having the thing that gets lost in games like that Memphis game, that was a grind of basketball, and it felt like Memphis was just beating the snot out of Davis and the rest of our team. But the flip side was also true. Marc Gasol was scoring freely, but nobody else on that team had a decent game at all. Like, it was we were working them defensively. We were doing a good job defensively on that Memphis team. And yes, there's not a lot of offensive talent there, but it, just the fact that we could do that. When was the last time you can remember the words Pelicans worked someone defensively in the last 5 years?
Right.
It just didn't happen. So
yeah,
it is improved. And
it is improved.
You can't say it's great, but it, like part of
Correct.
The thing too is if your offense is turning the ball over and they're live turnovers,
yes,
you're going to hurt your defense rating a little bit too. They're not completely separated from one another.
No, so. that's correct. That's absolutely correct. I was going to say exactly what you said is that to some extent in these games, it's the offense not doing what it's supposed to do, turning the ball over, scoring too soon, like with that screwed up alley-oop attempt. The main problem with that make or miss it is you're leaving time on the clock.
Yeah.
But whatever. I think the defense is improved, and I see room to improve.
Yeah.
Now, will it improve? I don't know. But I mean that more complimentary than I do as a negative, right? Like I'm not trying to impose a glass ceiling on them at 14 or 12 or whatever they're at. But that's, you know, good. But I think, like you said, I mean, what matters is the net. And when you're above average in pace, I think people think they run more than they do because people don't understand pace. But when you have that above average pace and the defense is giving you below average shots, you shoot yourself into the ground.
Right.
You're beating yourself by increasing the number of possessions.
Yep.
Which is tough. you know, I mean, that's like when people work themselves out of business by producing more. I mean, it's like, oh God, your heart hurts, you know, and you're like, just bless you, child, but please stop hitting yourself in the face.
Yeah. All right. Let's shift gears one more time. I want your hot take on this. Buddy Hield, mismanaged or completely mismanaged?
Yeah. So I'm not the hot take guy.
Oh, damn it.
But given those two, clearly mismanaged.
Okay. Clearly mismanaged. Buddy Hield has had games where he's played 6 minutes. He's had games where he's played 28 minutes. We saw him suddenly get a whole bunch of minutes in Oklahoma. What do you think about what's going on with Buddy? Do you think that what they're doing to him with the minutes going up and down is going to be detrimental to his future? Or do you think it doesn't matter? Do you think it does matter a little bit? What are you thinking?
Just talking about Buddy, I have no problem. I have no problem with what's going on. If they did it a little differently, I still wouldn't have a problem. I wrote a few weeks ago that they were clearly committed to giving Buddy minutes early on, and they were losing close games, and his offensive numbers were abysmal.
Hmm.
And that by committing to Buddy in those games, they probably cost themselves one or two wins when they had none. And I think that shows that they are committed to something. Now, part of it also showed that they needed some guard help, right? Yeah. But, and then when they started getting Drew back, I think people said, oh, well, now you're just going to forget about him. Part of part of the development is watching a game and knowing you're going to watch it, as opposed to, like, having to be on your heels and ready. So he sits a bit, he gets some garbage time minutes, which he should always get garbage time minutes,
yeah,
in my opinion. But then he comes back, and you could see some, at least I felt like I could imagine or at least charitably view some improvement in some of the things he was doing. Like, in his long shots, that's questionable as to whether they're better or not, right? But, I mean, I just feel like overall he seems to be a little calmer than he was early when he was sort of frenetic and was making bad decisions. And
jacking up shots.
Making bad decisions too quickly. Yeah.
Yeah.
This seems to be a bit better. But, I mean, you also have, I want to get Drew in and get him up to shape. I want to see what I'm dealing with. So if you say, well, you go ahead and watch a couple games and we're going to put you back in here, you give him the plan, you say, here's what I'm going to do with you, and you stick to that plan, you're not hurting his confidence. You're giving him time to watch and to learn in different ways. But all these other things that people don't see, the film room, the practice, talking with guys, it all matter. And it's different when you sit there and you know you're going to go in the game. You're not watching the game the same way than when you're just sucking it up, knowing that if the worst happens, you're going to go in.
Yeah.
I don't know. Do you buy that?
Yeah, I mean, so I think the one thing that's true about Buddy is even though he is the 22-year-old coming into the league and he's supposed to be ready-made, he's a guy who's had to make adjustments his entire life at different things. Like, he came into college and he was garbage and he had to make adjustments and then he figured it out. I think that's going to be the same kind of trajectory he has here. He's going to come into the NBA. He's going to work hard. He's going to make adjustments, and he'll get to a place where he's going to be a pretty decent player. Is he ever going to be a star? I doubt it. But it's not like he's guaranteed now to be a bust because he struggled at the beginning of the season. Like, I mean, how many times have we seen people just completely like give up on a player who then turns out to be a pretty solid guy because it was just year one or two of his career. So you got to give Buddy time. You got to let him like work things out. And like the one thing I will say is I don't watch Buddy. And other than when his handle is a little loose, and if he tries to run a pick and roll and negotiate that kind of defense, that makes me a little nervous. But when he takes a shot, I'm not like that's a. I've almost never think that's an awful shot. Maybe I think he should have squared up a little more in that situation. That's the worst I get. But I feel like he takes open shots when they're there. Sometimes it's appalling how bad he misses them. But then sometimes he looks great when he's stroking it. So, I don't have any problem with you taking that kind of player and saying, all right, we're gonna give you minutes. We're gonna give you time to learn. But we're also going to have moments where we're just you're not right now a matchup nightmare for anyone. So if we're in a situation where I do have a matchup problem for the team, I'm going to play that guy. If Langston Galloway's hitting every three-pointer, he's probably going to play over you.
Yeah, so I'm going to go for the dirty word trifecta here.
Okay.
So Austin Rivers.
Mm-hmm. God.
Yeah. So – So I, at the time, when this happened, I wouldn't say I defended Rivers, but that's probably what I did. When they said, well, he's had the worst rookie season up to this point of anybody ever in the NBA.
Yes.
Do you remember when he had this?
Oh, yeah. I wrote an article about how he was historically the worst ever.
Yeah. And what I said was, well, this is, you know, I mean, using the metrics, then it's in this way unambiguous. And if he used a different metric, he'd still be very close to the worst, right?
Yeah.
maybe. But so, but no, the, part of the issue there is
I don't think there's any question. Rivers. I think Rivers is that bad. Yeah, but okay.
Yeah. No, but part of the problem isn't Austin Rivers himself. It's that everyone else who's that bad doesn't get played.
Right.
He got played.
Right.
The reason he got played is because Eric Gordon showed up the day of the first game, right? I thought it was against the Spurs, but like, oh, God. And said, by the way, I'm not playing. And Monty lost it and said, you better get to California before I lay my hands on you.
Right.
In a nice Monty Williams way. And Eric Gordon to California and Monty Williams couldn't lay his hand on it. But, I mean, Eric Gordon went away. Austin Rivers basically had to soak up those minutes. And that was the end of Austin Rivers' career in New Orleans.
Yeah. That's true.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, that and the fact he shot 43% true shooting percentage.
I think these things are related. Dude, I used to sit in practice, okay, and count his free throws. He shot fine.
He's still okay? Not a good free throw shooter.
And correct. It's something up there, right? Yeah. And the dude accepted the challenge presented by Eric Gordon via Monty Williams.
Yeah.
And the fact that you can't play 4-on-4.
Right.
I think it messed with him. And it certainly messed with him in New Orleans because everyone was then sour against him. But dude, like I said, I used to sit there and watch him make shots at a rate that he could not reproduce at all. And again, from the free throw line.
Yeah.
Right? So everything else I'm sure is even worse. I don't want that to happen to Buddy Hield, but like I said, people act like it's a myth. I counted it. I've devoted my life to counting things, and I counted these. I know the difference. I just don't want that to happen to Buddy.
Yeah, I'm still not worried about Buddy at all. And part of the reason is because I think is after game 4, I was able to go on Twitter and say, hey, after the last game, Buddy Hield is officially not worse than Austin Rivers. So he passed that bar at least, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, he's already, you know, he's got the jetpack on straight to the moon.
That's right. He's not, yeah. We know that he's probably not going to have a historically awful rookie season.
Well, wait a second. The bar has to be higher because someone picked Austin Rivers at 10, but someone else picked Buddy at 6. So that must mean that Buddy's
right.
Better. Because who picks you where has a lot to do with you and not to do with them.
That's true. And technically, Buddy's only a 46% true shooting percentage right now. Yeah. Better.
Yeah. I just saw a soapbox and I wanted to stand on it. Sorry.
It's all right. Yeah, I mean, I know there's a lot of people out there who point to Jamal Murray, and, you know, it's a hard pick to defend over Jamal Murray. I'm not going to lie. But, you also have to take a look at the actual context of the draft and where people were on everybody's boards and where the general consensus is. And if you've convinced yourself that everybody on the planet knew that Jamal Murray, or even half the people on the planet knew that Jamal Murray was going to be way better than Buddy Hield, you've just, you know, bought into the hype. I mean, that was not the case.
There's a little bit of revisionist history going on a little bit. The other thing is I don't pay a lot of attention to the draft, meaning like I pay enough attention to know not what not to read. But, I mean, there is a difference between wrong and stupid. You know, you flip a coin, you can guess wrong.
Right.
But as long as you say heads or tails, you're not stupid.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
No. You could guess the edge. I guess that'd be stupid, though, wouldn't it?
That would be stupid.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Even if it's possible. You know, so I think there's a little bit of that, but I think that the idea that they went – for what they thought was more near-term production, and they sacrificed the potential allure of better production later, is probably a factor, and whether that's smart or stupid is a topic for discussion.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And I'll also just point out, like, if you went and looked at draftexpress.com before the draft, Buddy Hield was actually higher on the thing than Jamal Murray was. Just pointing that out.
Yeah. No, they weren't alone.
Yeah.
In that.
Yeah. So. Do I think that Buddy Hield's going to be a better player than Jamal Murray? No. But that's beside the point. One last final thing for you before we go. Do you think there's any chance, or let me change that, because it's always a chance, is there a better than 15% chance that we will see Alvin Gentry fired before the end of the season?
I don't think so.
Okay. Why?
Yeah. That one's always tougher.
I'm assuming you have a reason. Is you just make that declaration?
Yeah.
This isn't like, you know, first take.
Yeah. I mean, number one, I don't think that you're gonna fire a guy during the season when he's basically coach your team to 500 type ball, right? Like, you might be wanting to fire the guy, but in general, that's not fire the guy during the season kind of thing, unless there are some extenuating circumstances, like he's clashing with management, the players quit on him visibly, right? Which, by the way, that Lakers game disturbed me.
Yeah.
And I wrote about that.
Yeah.
So, I wouldn't have said zero, but it's going to be something more like that than, oh, I demand a higher winning percentage and you fell below it. I mean, Monty Williams got fired when they made the playoffs, still didn't. I mean, I can't, last season they were bad. You know, you could say, oh, well, Gentry was fresh. Well, now they just loaded up on Gentry guys. So now you're going to fire the guys. Well, you got 3 years left on Solomon Hill and some of these other dudes. Like, I'm not – there's that. I also don't think that with the ownership situation, you can bring in a real upgrade.
Okay.
I know other people – I know some people don't put stock in this. I do. That's fine. I think one reason they brought in Gentry was to try to get the best guy they could before the ownership situation really got sour. And unless the ownership situation gets resolved clearly and completely, Gentry's job is going to be safe through the season. Now, depending on how this pans out, I could see them eating the contract and firing him.
And you're meeting all of, like, the legal arguments over Benson's estates.
Yeah, okay. All that stuff with the trust.
Yeah.
All that nonsense. Yep.
Yeah.
I think that chews away top talent.
Yeah. I think the only way we're going to see this team have a different coach this season is if Benson or Loomis goes the route that they did with Jeff Bauer, where they were basically like, you know what, Byron Scott's gone. You say he's screwing up. This is the right team. You're coaching them the rest of the year. Then Dell Demps has suddenly turned into the head coach. It's a possibility that Gentry goes and then Demps is stuck with the team to coach. But I just don't see that really likely to happen. Like, you don't have like any sort of even history as a coach for Demps, and you did with Bauer. I think it's just the fact is Dell Demps, I think his last chance was this last summer, that they basically said, you bring in the guys you think are going to make a change. You rode with Alvin Gentry. You guys get to ride this season out, and you live with the results. And if we don't like the results, you're going to be replaced. And I think Danny Ferry's sitting there in the wings waiting. I'm still going to stick with my guns. I think Danny Ferry will be the the next person who makes a draft pick for the New Orleans Pelicans.
Interesting. I think if they clean house, they clean house, and he goes too. If they did the Jeff Bauer move, it wouldn't be Demps, it would be Ehrman.
Okay, I can see that.
But this is just rearranging the deck chairs. At that point, it's just hilarious.
Yeah, and nothing's going to change. So let me ask this question. Let's say Alvin Gentry is fired tomorrow. And they promote Darren Ehrman. Now he's now head coach. Because they're not going out and going to get any, like, there's no world where they're going to go out and get, like, a impact coach in the middle of a season. That doesn't work ever. Like, maybe you could go out and get George Karl, but George Karl is, you know, way past retirement age, and is he really an impact coach? Probably not. Like, the Jeff Van Gundys of the world are not going to come here in the middle of a season. They're going to want a giant contract, and it's going to take more than that.
So you could go back to the Warriors tree. You could bring back Mark Jackson.
That's true.
He already has a relationship with Ehrman.
And then you could set Ehrman to spy on him.
Yeah, I mean, so you don't have everything set up. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, because he's waiting, right?
Maybe we could also bring Scalabrine in, because I know he and Mark Jackson got along really well, too.
I mean, I'm just saying, if you're going to go down, just tear it all down.
Yeah, just make it a burning heap. No, but let's say Ehrman gets promoted. Like, is there any chance that this team turns it around if that happens? Like, is Alvin Gentry going away and somebody else from this coaching staff taking over going to have the tiniest bit of impact on this team?
Under no circumstances will anything like that lead to 500 ball.
Okay.
Right. You know what I'm saying? Like if for some reason Gentry's just lost the team,
right,
and they're going to win zero, then taking a complete Ehrman, Pack, any of those guys, I'm sure can do a fine job and get them in the neighborhood of that, like, you know, somewhere between one third and one half of the games, right? They would do just as good as Gentry in a different way. It's not going to boost, you know. I mean, that would be extremely lucky, and you'd have to not notice that guy has been sitting on your staff for the past year anyway.
Right.
And it has to be quiet and shut down,
right,
and be okay with it. Like, so that doesn't make any sense, logically.
Yeah, I mean, I really honestly cannot even remember any time a coaching staff has had a coaching change in the middle of a season in the NBA has actually made the team a better team. Like, I guess some people will try to point to Tyronn Lue taking over in Cleveland, but that was really a good team going to being a good team. Like, they made the finals the year before, like, and then they made the finals again. Like, I don't see a material change, and I can't come up with a coach that situation ever happened.
Yeah, the other thing too is, like, you know, Cleveland is an old team, and I know I'm supposed to say youth is better. It's not.
Right.
Okay. It's an experienced team, and that coaching, that coach is really a general, you know, directing these honed forces and trying to get them to work together right and to realize what the right game to play is in the game. Most teams are not in that situation.
Yeah.
Cleveland is aberrant in that regard. So, yeah, I don't see it. Let me ask you just one fun question before we go. Let's say we think the defense has, you know, gotten better and has the potential to improve. So let's reach in, freeze the defense, and take that potential, right? And we can place it somewhere else in a sort of Dungeons and Dragons attribute way, right?
Okay.
You're not allowed to boost the shooting, right? What kind of typical category would you go place that improvement? You can just rearrange the attributes. Would you put it in rebounding? Would you put it in assists or what?
No, I'd leave it where it is.
Turnovers?
Honestly, I'd leave it where it is. Like, the fact that we can defend without fouling and have a pretty decent effective field goal percentage, opponent effective field goal percentage is like, That's what this team needs. And, you know, if you can lay that foundation, and like that was kind of what I felt the theme of the offseason was laying the foundation, and then get like an offensive stud to put next to Davis. Like, really, that's what you need, is one offensive stud in that situation. Because you have all the defensive pieces around there that you can swap out one guy maybe a little bit less defensive-minded and plug him in offensively, and everything's going to click a little bit easier. It's going to be hard to find the offensive stud, but, you know, whatever. Like, at least you're in the situation where you can do that.
Yeah. I'd be willing to sacrifice a little defense, or at least a little defensive improvement, for a little more rebounding, particularly on the offensive end.
So
I don't know that that's attainable, but that's a way to increase your possession efficiency without increasing your shot efficiency.
Yeah. Did you read my article I wrote about this?
Putting
you on the spot. Did you read it?
I did.
Okay. So, like, poke holes in that idea. So for those of you who haven't read it, and it's on the site, you can go take a look if you want to. Essentially, they're right now posting a historically low offensive rebound rate. We're not talking even like a barely historically low. It's not like the last worst offensive rebound rate was 18.9% and they're at 18.7. I think the last record was around 19% and they're at a 17%. They're well below the historically worst offensive rebounding team ever. And it's by design. The coaching staff makes no bones about this. They say, we just tell them to get back. We don't try to go after offensive rebounds at all. And is it better? So if you go on the offensive glass and on average you get 3 or 4 more offensive rebounds, and offensive rebounds generate shots that are 5 to 10% more likely to go in than regular shots, is it worth getting those 3 or 4 extra shots on a possessions, or better shots on possessions, than it is getting back on defense for 75, 80 possessions in a game?
Right. Extremely valid question, right? So I think yes, okay? And it sort of depends on how you're doing it, right? So if what you're doing is telling 4 guys to crash the glass, right, then this is probably not good,
right?
If what you're doing is shooting 3s and long 2s, right, and you're telling guys, don't necessarily get back, but don't crash the glass, just pick up the long rebounds, because you're going to generate longer rebounds at a higher rate when you do that. That might be something you can do.
Okay.
Right? I mean, do you see what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
I think there's a little bit of a sort of brackish region between everybody this way and everybody that way. I agree with you 100% about the choice. The choice was made very early last season, if not before last season, and it's just persisted. And then last season was even worse because Oshik was hurt.
Right.
And Davis was doing a lot of the dirty work before, and then now he's doing less of that, and he's more of an offensive focus. So then that causes problems too. But I think these are all the – I'm trying to explain why I think that the offensive rebounding is so bad. But I think there are some things you can do to help yourself without committing those things. But beyond that, man, some of these dudes just have to do a better job.
Yeah.
I mean, like, and that kind of brings it back to Hill, and just, you know, people can rewind and listen to that part. And I mean, I know McNamara said, dude, just rebound, right? Like, I could at least not – I could hate you without grilling you publicly if you were rebounding.
Yeah.
Right? I think it's a faithful paraphrase.
Yeah.
I need something. And I'm willing to give up some defense for some rebounding, but I'm fine with defense too.
Yeah. Yeah, I do find it interesting that if you take a look at the I've always wondered, you know, if you send 2 people to the offensive glass, it doesn't necessarily mean that your transition defense is – or not even transition defense. You got to make sure that we're clear on that. If you send guys on the offensive glass, that's not necessarily your hurt. It's not transition defense, because in a lot of situations, transition defense is steals, which has nothing to do with the number of guys you sent on the offensive glass, because there's never been a shot. So you can't send guys on the offensive glass if you haven't taken a shot. So really what it is, and this is the part of the what I put in the article, it's really how does the defense perform after a made shot? Because you make a shot, you get back on defense, you're not trying to after a defensive rebound, because that's the contest point. And our team actually does pretty well. So I was always wondering, are there any teams that do offensive rebounding at a high rate and also have a good after defensive rebound defense? And the numbers actually, there's only two teams in the top 10 in defense after a defensive rebound who are also good offensive rebound rates. And they're ranked 18th and 16th. So, I mean, it's like there's actually a pretty good correspondence. Like, it actually matters. Getting back on defense really has an impact to your ability to defend in a set half-court situation. So, I mean, which shouldn't shock us. Like, the guys who have been, like, pitching this for years now are guys like Dom Thibodeau and Doc Rivers and Greg Popovich. These are the guys who have had teams that have, like, historically completely given up on offensive rebounding in almost every situation. Like, these are some of the smartest dudes in the league. Like, there's a reason why they're coaches, and they've been coaches for a really long time. So,
yeah.
I guess it shouldn't shock me. They probably have all kinds of studies in their back pocket, don't they?
Well, I mean, but there's also a point where, like, when you're in the middle of the pack, moving around in the pack may not make that big of a difference.
Right.
But maybe the pack is there for a good reason. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, at some point, you're like, you know, that it changes. And I'm not sure if we're there yet or not. But even just aesthetically, I want to see.
You want to see some putbacks? Yeah.
Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, you're tall. Right? So, act tall.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. I'm not going to get into making predictions because I'm so depressed already. Etuan Moore and Jrue Holiday are still listed as questionable for tomorrow's game against Philly. If we lose to Philly, the crying in my house will last all night. Like, that's just going to be depressing.
Yeah, that's gonna be a long night at the office if that happens.
Yeah, that's one of those games that you're just there's not really any good outcome. Even if they unless they like completely blow them out, that's a boring game. If they have a tight game, you're kind of like they barely beat Philly, or if they lose, you're like I can't believe they beat Philly. So, yeah. If there's any game I guess you guys should not watch, it'd be this Philly one is what I'm telling you, but I'll still be watching.
We might have guys sitting, we might have guys hobbled.
Right.
There's still definitely guys sitting. We have guys not on the team who are sitting, right? Yep. Stevenson. They're going to be playing Embiid, who seems good.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're going to have the Nerlens Noel staring in the face.
Right.
Right. Is he back yet?
I'm pretty certain he played a game.
Okay.
So
I know he had a D-League assignment. I didn't in the past couple of days. It's been busy. But yeah. So, but I mean, if he plays and Jrue Holiday doesn't, it's just going to be so annoying. It's going to be so annoying.
Yeah. No, I'm wrong. Noel is not back with the team yet.
Not back with the team yet? Okay, yep. He's still doing the D-League thing.
Still doing the D-League thing, getting back into shape. So,
well, at least every nail's not in the coffin or in my eyes.
Right. So it'll be the Embiid and the Dario Saric, because I know there's a lot of you out there who remember the Pelicans had expressed interest in Dario Saric. They had wanted to bring him in a couple different times and never really worked out. So it'll be interesting to watch that game. So thanks, everybody, for listening to In the Know. And I don't know. It's kind of, was this a depressing podcast? Might have been a depressing podcast.
Not McNamara depressing.
You're right. We don't have McNamara saying here, they're going to be bad for the next 10 years. Just give up now.
Rainbow. Yeah. That's me, dude.
All right. Thanks for listening to the podcast.